Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Hans Schmidt, and we're going to be talking about his book, Maverick General. It's the story of Major General Smedley Butler, certainly one of the most colorful military commanders of all time. Hans, are you there? Hans, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, just
okay.
Fine.
Yeah, the title of the book is Maverick Marine.
Maverick Marine, okay, fine. Well, you go ahead and why don't you tell us how it happened that you decided to write a book on Smedley Butler?
I had done a study on the U.S. occupation of Haiti. That was from 1915 to 1934 when the Marines were running that country. And Smedley Butler was one of the prime characters involved there, especially in the early phase of that occupation. And so I just picked him up, and that involved me with a lot of the other interventions, military interventions in the Caribbean, Central America. And that when I started working on that project, I got a job in Hong Kong, and I was teaching out there for a number of years. And so that was good for the China side of that.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you just tell our listeners who Major General Smedley Butler was, why he is important, and why I wish we had a few more men like him in the military today.
Yeah. Well, he joined the Marine Corps as a 16-year-old in 1898 at the time of the Spanish-American-Cuban War. And was in the Marines then. From that point, the intervention in Cuba, right through the 1920s, until he retired in the early 1930s, and that involved him in just about all of the American military interventions overseas during that era. During this time, the Marine Corps itself was an expeditionary force that was used for these, I call them colonial light infantry wars, the small wars, as they were called, banana wars in Central America. And so he had all of this experience and was an insider in the sense that his father was the chairman of the House Naval Affairs Committee for most of those years, a congressman for 32 years. So Smedley knew pretty much what was going on and had the support of his father in his own career.
Well, do you think that helped him as far as his advancement to the rank of general?
Sure. Well, maybe not to as far as general, but it certainly did in his early career.
All right, yeah. Fine. Well, why don't you just tell us a little bit about our listeners out there? Most people don't know Smedley Butler's career, but it certainly spanned, almost 30 years in military service, and, of course, was marked certainly by a great deal of controversy, and even more controversial when he left the military. So you tell the story.
So he was involved in the military interventions, and then in the 1920s he became well known domestically in the United States because he took over the running of the Philadelphia Police Force. He was director of public safety in Philadelphia for several years, and this was fighting crime and vice in the Prohibition era. The police were militarized. They wore sand brown belts and practiced under Smedley Butler firing their machine guns from police cars at targets that were set up and so forth. And so this was quite controversial. And Butler became well known for smashing crime and vice, which was the title of one of the newspaper serials.
All right, fine. Of course, he was a great admirer of the FBI. He really believed in fighting crime, but he also was very critical of certain elements within our government during those days. In fact, he was actually approached and asked to lead an effort to overthrow the government and establish a different form of government here in the United States.
Right. So Butler, while he was still in the Marine Corps, as the ranking major general, the most senior general in the Marine Corps, in the late 1920s and early 1930s, began making speeches criticizing the government for military interventions, as in Nicaragua. So he described in his speeches how he, as a Marine officer, had helped rig elections in Nicaragua and in Haiti and in other of these military occupations. And so he was then, this of course did not sit well with the government, with President Hoover. And Butler just kept on going, being critical. He got into a lot of trouble criticizing Mussolini and was actually court-martialed for this by the Hoover administration, except the government dropped the charges when there was a public outcry in support of Butler.
And basically, of course, he was very, very critical of what had happened because he suddenly realized that he had actually been a muscle man for big business and for the bankers, and he was very critical of this, the wealthy elite who were using the American military to further their imperialistic goals. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, I guess so. And this carried through his long-time commitment as a Marine officer to be a soldier's general. So he was always on the side of the enlisted man and continued to do so in his retirement. He was in the 1930s then a main speaker on the veterans circuit, the Veterans of Foreign War and the American Legion. And the VFW, in fact, became a sort of anti-war organization and featured Butler as one of their spokesmen.
Well, you know, it's strange to think of a military general being anti-war, but he had fought in so many wars, and he realized the futility of them, and that the wars were never fought for the reasons that the American people really were ever allowed to know. So why don't we, perhaps, when we get back and we get all of our stations on board, we could perhaps chronicle his career.
Okay.
Starting, of course, with the war, the Spanish-American War in 1898, which was a totally senseless and needless war. Most people don't understand that. And, of course, I think one of the things that led to this Philippine-American War, which most people have never even heard of, or do they understand the brutality of that war, that was waged by the American forces against people who just wanted to be free and determine the destiny of their own nation. The Philippine-American War, one of those wars we never talk about. So let's get a little bit into the history, and we'll be back here in just a moment with our special guest. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Hans Schmidt. We're talking about his new book, Maverick Marine, going into the life of Major General Smedley Butler, who actually had two congressional medals of honor. Did anybody else ever get two congressional medals?
There was one Marine Sergeant, Dan Daly, who also got two congressional medals. And so they're still mentioned in Marine Corps training programs and so forth.
Well, why don't you just go ahead and tell the story, starting with Smedley Butler, starting out as a second lieutenant during the Spanish-American War, that's 1898, and then why don't you just sort of chronicle his history?
Okay, so this was the Spanish-American-Cuban War, and he was, of course, underage, entering as age 16, but he did get to Cuba, did not see any action. The unit was in Guantanamo, and the battle had already been fought and won there. And so he was just a kid, and as an officer, you know, just made an officer by virtue of the fact of having influential father, a congressman, and so forth. And he served in Cuba, and then Philippines, twice in the Philippines, in fact. But during the Philippine War for Independence, and the Filipinos, of course, were expecting after the Spanish colonialism had been defeated, that they would be free, and they were hoping this, and there were indications too that the U.S. had more or less promised them informally that they would be supported in their independence. But then, of course, the Americans put down the the Filipino insurrectos, and the rather bloody episode there, and set up this as an American colony, which became Cuba and the Philippines became main overseas naval bases for the United States. The Guantanamo Bay became a naval station for the American Caribbean Fleet, and and in the Philippines, Longapo, where Smedley Butler served in 1905 and 6, was also the major U.S. Military base in East Asia. While he was in the Philippines in 1900, there was an uprising in China, the Boxer Rebellion, Boxer Uprising, and Butler was part of the American contingent of Marines who went into China and to put down the Boxers and relieve the siege against foreign nationals in Tianjin and Beijing. And so this was the most famous military episode of the turn of the century. And Butler was a teenage hero there, despite being so young and just a junior officer. He was a battlefield hero, wounded and cited for valor and so forth. And he was breveted to become a captain. Pretty amazing that at 19 years old, here he is a captain. This is in the time when the Marine Corps was had been quite small, and the senior officers in the Marine Corps had been for decades at ranks like, you know, lieutenant and finally making captain and so forth. After 30 years of service, Civil War officers being promoted to captain in 1898, and here's Smedley Butler in 1900 as a 19-year-old captain. From China times then, he was back in the United States briefly, and then involved in military interventions in Honduras, Panama three times, and then again, as I mentioned, he was serving in the Philippines, and most famously, I think, in Nicaragua.
But I've heard a lot of these, of course, having to do with the American Food Company to ensure that the American corporations would be able to dominate banana production in Central America.
Exactly, yes. So in the Caribbean coast of Honduras, United Fruit and Standard Fruit, American capitalist corporations, set up plantations there to have ships running to the urban markets in the United States, selling these bananas, and did so since the Honduran Caribbean coast was not very heavily populated. They actually brought in laborers from the West Indies, and so this was a plantation kind of setup with some white managers from the United States and these fruit corporations, and then black West Indian workers doing the heavy lifting.
And of course, certainly, Major General Smedley Butler, at that time, I'm assuming he was still a captain or maybe moving towards major.
Yes, that's right.
Certainly was, was simply doing what he was told to do. But I think he had a realization that a lot of what was going on was simply imperialism, and he tended to resent it. But when did he begin to express some of his misgivings about his military activities?
Well, in his private correspondence, at the time he was in Nicaragua. So from about 1906, 1907 through 1914, he commanded a battalion that was based in Panama. And they were there ready to go up either coast of Central America, Pacific or Caribbean coast, to land and take over control in the interest of the United States. And so while he was doing this, he went three times into Nicaragua in military interventions there and took over the country. And in his private correspondence, he would mention things like how nasty it was that here they were killing people, dominating them, and some Marines were being killed in the interest of Brown Brothers, Wall Street banking firm, and how this was not really an honorable thing to do. And so he was pretty sensitive about this, as indeed many other American military personnel were.
But of course, there was nothing that could be done as long as he was on active duty. And then, of course, really, what part did he play in World War One?
In World War One, he had been in Haiti, in the marine occupation of Haiti, and wanted so much to get to Europe to fight in the war in Europe. And eventually got there, but only got as far as the French coast in Brest, and was put in charge of the major embarkation base in Brest, Camp Pantanesen, where most of the million of American soldiers went through there on the big ships coming in, and then of course the soldiers proceeded to the front. Butler remained in charge of that camp, which was Camp Mud. It was raining so much, and of course with all of those soldiers going through there, staying in tents, and it was during the influenza epidemic of 1918, and so many of them were dying, and so that was quite a rough job for him to do, and he never got to the front, and so he was disappointed by that, but was nevertheless playing a significant role for the services of supply, as they were called, the support troops and so forth at the embarkation base.
All right, fine. Well, now, after the First World War, did he see any more military action before he eventually was forced to retire?
Well, in the 1920s, he was involved as a base commander in Quantico, and then, as I mentioned previously, there he was taking off for a couple of years to be director of public safety in Philadelphia, in charge of the police and fire departments. And in 1927, then, back in the Marines, he went to China for military intervention there, which lasted until 1929.
And what was that military intervention at that? Since the Boxer Rebellion had been before that, so what was happening there in 27 and 28?
In 27, this was the Nationalist Revolution, and the development of a nationalist movement by the Chinese Nationalist, the Kuomintang Party, Chiang Kai-shek, this is, threatened the foreigners in Shanghai and in Beijing and other treaty ports. And so various of the great powers, the United States included, sent in troops to protect their interests, to protect the lives of and property of American citizens in China, and many missionaries and so forth, and also businessmen. And Butler was in charge of the Marines in Shanghai, and later on they moved up to Tianjin in North China. And as he subsequently put it looking back at this in the 1930s, he said, "I spent my years going around the world guarding Standard Oil tins." So that in fact the Marines were using Standard Oil properties in China and protecting them at the same time, of course, flying their airplanes up from Standard Oil bases and so forth.
Well, of course, he certainly was beloved by his troops, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, right.
Well, then, of course, at what point did he retire?
Let's see, I guess in 1931 he finally retired, right, yep.
And, of course, that would be sort of the end of a career for most people, but not with Smedley Butler. In fact, it was after that that really some of the most important parts of his story actually took place. So why don't you suddenly follow what happened after that? Because in 1932, 33, we were having the Great Depression. There was a lot of unrest in the country. So why don't you tell that part of the story?
Yeah, in 1932, then, he got into politics and ran for the U.S. Senate for the Republican nomination for Pennsylvania, but he lost. And while doing this, of course, he was making lots of speeches, and he continued to do so as a private citizen. He sort of made a living. He had his retirement pay, of course, but went around the country making speeches, and these were political speeches, and his themes were having to do with imperialism. He is making, let's see now.
When did he make that famous speech we actually reproduced in one of our newsletters, where War is a Racket? It was just I know he wrote a book by that title, but he actually had an essay which he wrote, which was widely circulated.
Yes, he had been writing many articles, magazine articles, newspaper serials, series, and of course in his speeches.
Hold that thought, we'll be back in just a moment.
Yep.
Well, I guess it's Hans Schmidt we're talking about, his book, Maverick Marine, and we're talking about, of course, Major General Smedley Butler, Now that he's retired, he's giving speeches, and he's, of course, he's...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances? Even things which can cause sickness or disease. If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
War is a Racket. He subsequently wrote a book by this title. And, of course, we actually reduplicated that in one of my newsletters. It's a short summary of it. Of course, the book, which Hans has actually written, much more extensive, the story of Major General Smedley Butler, a very colorful figure. And then we get around to about 1934. Of course, he retires in 31. He's going on a nationwide speaking tour. Veterans are certainly inviting him to come. The veterans have been promised a bonus, for their valiant service in World War One, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt would not pay that, and there was a veterans march on the White House. And how did Smedley Butler feel about the fact that American troops fired on American veterans?
Yeah, so this is the bonus march in 1932. So Hoover was still president at that time. So it's before Roosevelt comes in. The bonus marchers were entitled to a bonus for having served in World War I, but they weren't going to be paid according to the existing law until 1945. And so they crusaded to be paid off early because of the Depression. And so they marched on Washington, and came, many of them, with their families, wives and children, and camped in the Anacostia River mudflats within sight of the Capitol, and were sort of lobbying for their bonuses. And Butler encouraged them. He was a proponent of paying the bonus immediately and had been making speeches on this subject for some time. That's what he told the veterans organizations when he made speeches before them in their conventions. And he went to Washington to the bonus encampment and stayed with them, stayed overnight with his son Smedley Jr., and made speeches encouraging them. He said, "You have as much right to be here lobbying the government as the United States Steel Corporation does, and stand up for your rights," but being careful, of course, to tell them to not to violate the law in any way. Don't do anything legal. Keep it clean. But, you know, you have a right to be here and state your case. But then, of course, the Hoover administration sent in the Army under the Chief of Staff, General Douglas MacArthur, and routed the bonus encampment and burned down their shanties and tents. And this was a very unpopular move by the Hoover administration, and was one of the things one of many things that discredited them during this time period.
And then, of course, Hoover is defeated in 1932. FDR comes in 1933. But then, of course, I think one of the most significant parts of the story is what happened in 1934, where Smedley Butler is approached by a gentleman supposedly representing Thomas Lamont of J.P. Morgan and Company, and asked to lead an effort to overthrow the democratically elected government of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Do you want to tell that story? Because I think it's so vitally important today.
Yeah, well, this is the 1934 fascist plot, so-called, which Butler exposed. And so he told some journalists about this, and it became, you know, banner headlines for a few days at least, and then petering out over time. And this was investigated by the House Un-American Activities Committee. And so it was a sort of like a show trial with a great deal of attention being paid in the newspapers, but not really a trial in the sense of being a criminal procedure. It was more or less seeking information. So the House Un-American Affairs Committee then at this time was looking into not just communism as in the later days, but fascism as well. And so their investigators turned up various evidence which tended to support Butler in that he was approached and offered money by a bond salesman who represented, as Butler thought later on, the American Liberty League, which was just being formed at this time. And the committee investigations brought out a lot of information which substantiated Butler, but it was not really definitely conclusive, nor was anybody prosecuted for this. The House Un-American Affairs Committee had no authority to actually prosecute anybody.
Well, I think what's really so important about that is, of course, Lamont was an important part of J.P. Morgan and Company. Today, J.P. Morgan and Company really is part of this establishment that owns our government, that runs our government. J.P. Morgan, Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, two of the largest banks in the United States, are one of the dominant forces behind the people who control the Obama administration. But going right along with Goldman Sachs and many of the other banks who were around at that time, they were involved in this plot to seize the White House. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Hans Schmidt. And do you want to pick up on that story of the, in fact, Jules Archer eventually wrote a book entitled The Plot to Seize the White House. And in fact, he was living here in our area, and I tried to get him to come on the program, but he was, his mind was very, very clear, but he was hard of hearing, and we never had an opportunity to interview him, and then he passed away here about, three or four months ago. But,
oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, it was a fascinating book, The Plot to Seize the White House, which we do, incidentally, carry here through Radio Liberty. We think it's an important part of history. But you pick up the story of what happened in this plot. Do we know much about it?
Yeah, well, Archer's book is the whole book is just on the plot, and so he goes into much greater detail than I do. We're just mentioning it sort of in passing as part of Butler's many activities during those years. And so this was investigated by the House Un-American Activities Committee, and they came up with a lot of evidence and it seemed to substantiate many details of what Butler had said. So he came out of it looking okay, in the sense that he was not caught lying or anything like that. And many of the people whom he was accusing of this fascist conspiracy were proven by the committee to have been liars, and that they were deceitful and caught out as having been manipulative and having been linked to the powerful group that was dominating the American Legion during those years, and these were Wall Street bankers as well. So the result of all that, since the committee was expiring, the committee's mandate to investigate fascism and communism and so forth, un-American activities, was expiring, and so they couldn't really proceed beyond just calling witnesses, and didn't even have the right to subpoena people and to coerce them. And so House Un-American Activities was terminated, there was no inclination to pursue this story any further.
But don't you think the reason wasn't because there was a lot of powerful money that wanted to keep this story from being publicized? Because most people have never heard of the plot to seize the White House in 1934, and we'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Hans Schmidt. His book, Maverick Marine, the story of Smedley Butler. Before we go on, Hans, I'd like you to get out your website, if you have one, and tell people how they can get your book.
Well, the book is available through Amazon.com and through bookstores, indeed. Also, of some interest in terms of this war as a racket is if you Google Smedley Butler, you'll find that there is a video that has been done by some people in South Carolina, which is a reenactment of War as a Racket, in the sense that the actor is then reading from the book War as a Racket, and so you get a pretty good impression then of what Butler was up to.
All right, and of course, as we were saying during the break, the reason this is important is because the major bankers, Thomas Lamont worked for J.P. Morgan, J.P. Morgan at that time, and of course they wanted to establish a fascist dictatorship. Well, of course, they were exposed by Major General Smedley Butler, and the plot was investigated by the House Un-American Activities Committee, and nothing came out of it. Of course, they've done away with the House Un-American Activities Committee. There is no investigation. The subversive elements, in my estimation, are in total working control of our government today, dedicated to globalism and destroying our tariff system so that our manufacturing is no longer competitive throughout the world. And the descendants of the bank J.P. Morgan that existed at that time is J.P. Morgan Chase. And then, of course, we have Morgan Stanley, and they, I'd say, are two of the three largest banks in the United States, the third one being Goldman Sachs. But for all intents and purposes, they are already manipulating behind the scenes what's really going on in Washington, D.C. today. So even though Major General Smedley Butler exposed their efforts back in 1934, There's no one who is able to expose the efforts of this small clique of extremely wealthy people as they work behind the scenes today, moving us from war to war to war. Well, what happened to a Major General Butler after he exposed the plot to seize the White House?
He continued telling the story of the plot. So in those days, in the mid-1930s, he was on national radio. So they would broadcast on a sort of shortwave, and before there were networks, as we know them more recently. And so he made long radio addresses and accusing, you know, the House Un-American Activities Committee of not having called the major witnesses. And the people who were exposed during the investigation were the middlemen. So Butler was approached by several people, bond salesmen and so forth, who were employed by big banks and so forth. But they were not able to actually conclusively link these people, the intermediaries, with the financiers who were starting at this very moment the American Liberty League, which was a major right wing organization of the mid and late 1930s, which was having as its primary officers many of the major bankers, such as you have mentioned.
All right, fine. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, if you have a question or comment on this story, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, after the plot to seize the White House was exposed, and of course that incidentally is the title of a book written by Jules Archer, after the plot was exposed, what happened to Major General Smedley Butler?
In the late 1930s, he continued with the same theme, anti-war theme, and was a proponent of reform movements like the proposed Ludlow Amendment, which would have required a constitutional amendment, which would have required a national plebiscite before the country could go to war. Butler was advocating laws that would prevent the American Navy and Air Force from extending itself beyond protecting the United States and Panama Canal. And so this was the anti-war movement, which Butler's major contribution was having to do with the veterans organizations, especially Veterans of Foreign Wars, VFW, but also in the mid and late 1930s included many church groups who would attend rallies and Butler would speak to them sometimes, and there was a peace movement on campuses. Many student organizations were opposed to war. And there was a sort of a national sense that the First World War had been corrupt. There were investigations in the Senate and in Congress during the 1930s exposing war profiteering from World War I.
Well, not only that, but there was no reason for America to have got into the war. I mean, the whole thing was manipulated from the very beginning. Certainly the sinking of the Lusitania. The State Department knew that the Germans had said they were going to sink the ship, and that the State Department, the United States State Department, was encouraging American citizens to go on the Lusitania that they knew was going to be torpedoed by the Germans because the Germans had said so. And yet they wanted to use that as a vehicle for demonizing the Germans. And, of course, all the propaganda that J.P. Morgan and company had bought up the editorial policies of 25 of our major newspapers. This had been exposed by Congressman Oscar Calloway. We have, and if you'd like to see his article, we have it from the Congressional Record, talking how J.P. Morgan, banking company, along with their friends, people of great wealth, had bought up the major media to propagandize the American people to get us to go into World War I. And after the war was over, and of course we'd lost 125,000 American soldiers, people were saying, why did we go into this war? I mean, all these atrocity stories they told us, They just weren't true, sort of like the atrocity stories they used to get us into the first Gulf War, you know, where the soldiers were bayoneting the little children that they threw out of the bastionets. It was all a lie, but it's amazing when you control the media, how you can manipulate the public. But anyway, during this period leading up to the Second World War, nobody wanted to get into another war. This Second World War was the war clouds were rising over Europe, and suddenly it was very obvious that there was going to be a war in Europe. Of course, most people didn't know the American corporations were providing the weapons for Adolf Hitler, the best enemy we could possibly buy, in preparation for dragging America into World War II. So what happened at that time? You say there were a lot of organizations out there that were anti-war. Isn't it a shame we don't have a lot more organizations today which are anti-senseless wars?
Right. Yep. This was, of course, the high point in middle and late 1930s. And because of the anti-war movement, the government, Franklin Roosevelt and so forth, were very careful not to be too overt about preparations for war, and to sort of keep that Roosevelt ran for re-election in 1940 as an anti-war candidate.
I remember that. Yes. I hate war. Yes. Eleanor hates war.
Yes.
Even
yes.
Little Fowler, that was his dog. Even yes. Little Fowler hates war. And he was already planning on taking us into a war. He was lying. Just like politicians always lie, they say one thing about getting out of wars and then they continue them. But you go right ahead.
Okay, so Smedley Butler continued right up until the end. He died in 1940 then with this anti-war theme and very dramatically dramatizing such things. So here's, I have a speech he made in 1939, a radio broadcast introduced by a United States Senator Clark, alluding to the First World War in the trenches. Somewhere 5,000 miles from home, night, darkness, cold, the drizzling rain, the noise is terrific, all hell has broken loose. A star shell bursts in the air, an unearthly flare lights up the muddy field, there's a lot of tangled, rusty, barbed wires out there, and a boy is hanging over them, his stomach ripped out. And he's feebly calling for help and water. His lips are white and drawn. He's in agony. So this is then to the mothers of America. Your boy might go out there and face that sort of thing. There's your boy, the same boy who's lying in bed tonight, etc. So he was a very dramatic, very emotional guy, and was just going all out, exhausting himself as he was quite ill, in fact, and came home finally from the speech-making trip and died shortly thereafter.
Well, he was a very heroic figure. What is your impression after having spent a lot of time studying his background, his history, and studying his biography, writing a biography of him?
It was really interesting. It's a really interesting man who had a rich and diverse life and was quite bold in speaking out Not exactly a deep thinker. Much of his anti-war rhetoric, for instance, was the same thing people have been saying ever since the 18th century in American history. So there's a long tradition of pacifism in American history. And so Butler was picking up on this. And of course he had the added convincing quality of having been through it all himself, so that he was involved in many of these major military incursions as the United States became a great power in the early 20th century and began its domination of satellite states and invasion.
But of course he was against American imperialism. I think most Americans are against American imperialism, except that they never tell us that we are an imperialistic nation. This is the tragedy.
Yeah, right. Well, Smedley Butler will tell you.
Right, and I just wish we had a few Smedley Butlers out there today talking about America's empire and asking, why do we have troops stationed in Germany over 60 years after the Second World War ended? Why do we still have troops stationed in Japan 60 years after the war ended? Why won't Obama pull our troops out of Iraq, where he promised he would? Or And why is he expanding the war in Afghanistan? Nobody wants to ask those questions. Well, let's go to John, who's calling us from Albany, New York. And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Hi, John. How are you doing tonight?
Good evening, Dr. Stan. I'm fine, thank you. And good evening to your guest. I apologize, I didn't catch his name.
His name is Hans Schmidt, and his book is Maverick Marine.
Yes, I'm familiar with the name Smedley Butler and also with his famous quote. But I'm not familiar with his life, and I'm curious, did he agonize regarding his realization that war is a racket over a long period of time, or did it come to him towards the end of his military career? The reason I ask the question is because I must admit I'm skeptical of high-ranking officers and other people who, after long government service now with a pension, believe that it's safe to sort of go against the grain. Come to the, you know, they can say things, well, gee, when I was a lieutenant, I didn't think war was a racket, but now I do. In any case, I wonder if your guest can offer any insight on that when he came to the realization of racket.
Yeah, well, he, as a Marine and being overseas in all these military interventions, was writing home all the time. So it's common from a historian's point of view. You have a real treasure trove of letters over many, many years written to his parents, written to his wife. And in these letters, even as a young man from the time of Nicaragua and Panama and so forth in the early 1900s, he would mention things like how American business interests were involved and how regrettable this was. And the military officers, Butler very much amongst them, felt that their own honor, here they were serving their country as soldiers, risking their lives and so forth, that this was being done for commercial reasons, that it was for the good of the bankers and for the good of the American corporations.
And John, if you have a chance, if you haven't read my newsletter, War is a Racket, you can just go to our website, radioliberty.com, and scroll down and read the essay, and then I'm sure you'll want to get the whole book. It's fascinating. Anything else?
Well, I'm glad. It does sound like he did the general agonized over that, and that's a relief to hear that. And I would like to say that I believe World War II was fought to make the world safe for communism.
Well, whatever it was fought for, it certainly wasn't fought to bring freedom to the world. It was really fought to bring about a new world order, and to bring about the United Nations, a stepping stone to that age-old plan of the secret societies to establish a one-world government and a one-world leader. Anyway, God bless, and thanks so much, John. Anything else
you
want to say before we let you go?
That'll do it. Thank you, Doc.
Okay, good night. And let's go to Mike calling in Connecticut. From Connecticut, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Hi. It's always great. Your show gets better every night that I listen to it. I love it on shortwave. I hope you'll never get tired of hearing me calling in.
Not at all.
Excellent about the fellow Butler. I read about him years ago as someone being in the pro-gun movement about what he said about at the turn of the century, helping the corporations, to go into the Philippines. And I was just wondering, there's a woman named Catherine Austin Fitz. She does some, she used to work for Housing and Urban Development, and she knows that there's trillions of dollars missing from the feds. And she said that our military is actually helping to prop up the dollar because the rest of the world is frightened of what we might do. Do you know anything about that as far as our continuing, around the world, what we're doing? And before that, in addition to that, why in God's name are we in Afghanistan? I think I know. For the heroin or the poppies?
The heroin, the poppies, and of course oil pipelines. That's the real reason.
Yes,
the war was planned long before the 9/11 attack. In fact, the plan for the attack on Afghanistan was sitting on the president's desk the very morning of the 9/11 attack. What a coincidence. And you'll find that, I think that was Richard Clark's book actually tells that story. And anyway, anything else, Mike, you want to say before we let you go?
We're propping them up. It's run by Sharia law. And our good boys, have targets on their backs. And Obama increases the troop presence. And, if it was a Republican in office, I mean, there's probably not a dime worth of difference between two parties. But then the press goes along with this farce over there. And I just, you have a great show. Thank you.
God bless. Thanks very much. Well, let's go to Henry, who's calling us from New England. Hi, Henry. Do you have a question for our guest?
Yeah, here's my question. What about this nonsense, which I think would really be suicide, with, what's his name, McCain, Obama, and, well, certainly Bush and McCain, but even Obama, trying to edge on a war with, or trying to threaten Russia with the anti-missile system on the border of Poland, the radar thing on the border of Czechoslovakia, pointed toward Russia.
Well, you know, what was it that's been said? Only the dead have seen the end of war. And I fear that that is the tragedy. I think we're moving towards another war, and I think everything is being set up for a war with Russia and China, and may God forgive us. But it's not the American people. It is the small clique of evil men in charge, the same ones who were there that Smedley Butler fought. Well, Henry, anything you want to say before we let you go?
Yeah, well, I want to find out what your guests may think about that. I don't know if they're trying to have a war with China. They would like to help the Chinese, I know, because they're communists and the slave labor.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look. I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
With food prices soaring to all-time highs, as the dollar continues to fall in value, what can you and your family do to guarantee that fresh, nutritious vegetables will make it to your dinner table? Garden in a Can. Garden in a Can is your source for premium, long-term storable seeds. Garden in a Can is ready when you are. Plant them now or store them for when you really need them. There are 16 large, hermetically sealed, non-hybrid, open-pollinated packets of seeds, along with detailed planting instructions sealed in a can for ultimate long-term protection. Garden in a Can. It's that simple. Fresh, healthy, easy. Only $69.95 for over a half acre of safe, fresh vegetables. Ready when you are. Stop procrastinating and start preparing with Garden in a Can. For more details, visit GardenInACan.com today. That's GardenInACan.com or call 866-598-7396, 866-598-7396.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
The powerful spiritual forces working behind the scenes, moving us towards this one world government, the fulfillment of the ancient prophecies. Why, we do hope if you're in a position to help, you will. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. I know a lot of people are having real problems today. And I certainly understand. But if you can't help us, just tell other people about our program. That's how we're building up a listening audience all over the world. I got a wonderful letter, email just this morning from somebody in France who listens to our program. And we know we have listeners there. And certainly in Switzerland and in Germany and in England and Ireland and Norway and Sweden and, well, all over the world, people listen to our internet programs. What a privilege it is to have an international audience. So if you're in a position to help, why, go to our website, radioliberty.com, and there on the lead page is a donate button. And if you push it, you can see what happens. Then, of course, we certainly want to remind you that we are going to be doing a conference tomorrow. That's up in the at the Conspiracy Conference. That'll be starting Saturday morning, and I'll be giving the lead-off talk. That's at the Marriott Hotel on the Great American Parkway in Santa Clara, and it's too late now to get the advanced registration, but you can pay at the door, and it'll be an interesting time. There'll be a lot of people there. And some of them you'll agree with and some of them you won't agree with, but you'll find out there are a lot of people who believe there's a conspiracy, and it's just understanding what that conspiracy is. And, of course, if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to. You need to hear my talk on the forbidden secret and the syllabus that goes with that. The talk on the financial Armageddon and the syllabus that goes with that is vitally important. The financial Armageddon, because, of course, this whole current financial collapse throughout the world is all carefully engineered and is being perpetuated by people who have a different worldview. And until you understand what that worldview is, you can't understand what's going on. We put together a syllabus called the Membership List of the Brotherhood of Darkness, because you really can't identify the players unless you understand who they are. And so you have to have a program, and that's what the Membership List of the Brotherhood of Darkness is. It will give you the information you need to have to understand what's really going on in the world today. And then, of course, we do hope many of you out there will certainly want to get some of our other material. We have if you want to know the story of Major General Smedley Butler, we do have the book, The Plot to Seize the White House. We have a book on General Patton. They set out to kill General Patton, the book Target Patton. And then, of course, we have the interviews with the author of that book and the 4-CD set, Deadly Assassins. That's Deadly Assassins. If you want to understand the origin of all the wars dating back to 1898, of course, the story is Untold Iraq, the Untold Story, or War, the Untold Story. The two talks, but they're essentially the same. One may be a little better choreographed, really more impressive, but they all tell the same story, but you have to get the syllabus with that to really understand the futility of the war. All wars have been contrived. The Spanish-American War was contrived. The Boer War was contrived. The First World War, the Second World War. Korea, how did they get us into Korea? Why didn't we try to win? Do you know that they wouldn't even let, according to General MacArthur, they wouldn't let him bomb the major supply depots in North Korea? Why? Because we tried to win the war. We could have, and we were never to win the war. We didn't go there to win, and any more than we went to Vietnam to win. Any more than we certainly could have taken Saddam Hussein out in the first Gulf War, and we didn't try. And, of course, today, why, of course, we're fighting the Taliban, and we're financed by the United States, and are financed today by the Pakistani government that we're financing. 1-800-544-8927. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or the supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Robert Schopmeyer. That's Robert Schopmeyer, and we're going to be talking about his book on foreknowledge of 9-1-1. What's the exact title, Robert?
Prior Knowledge of 9-11.
Prior Knowledge of 9-11. So I'm just going to let you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you had to prior knowledge of 9-11, you have discovered about this tragic day in American history.
Well, I'm an electrical engineer, and I had my own company, and I was traveling between Yokohama, Japan, and had gone to the Narita Airport, and was going from the Narita Airport to San Francisco out to New York, and I'd bought a magazine at the Narita Airport, and I did not have a chance to read it on the way back to San Francisco, so I had the magazine on me when I was going out to New York City. That was on February 11th.
February 11th of 2001. This was
2001,
about,
yes.
This was about 7 months before the 9/11 attacks. So pick up the story.
Yeah, and then what had happened is I wasn't even going to read the magazine. It was on the Al Qaeda terrorists, and I just thought it was such a horrible subject I wasn't going to read it. But I didn't have had a chance to buy anything else. I was reading the magazine for lack of anything else to do, and I started reading it. And the first thing it said is that the Bin Laden had 20 training camps in Afghanistan, and I went, my God, I didn't realize that. I thought he had two or three. I didn't know he had 20. And then it said he had 20,000 terrorists go through these training camps. 10,000 of them were called martyrdom training. And martyrdom training meant they were going to carry out suicide attacks, many of them, in the United States. And I went, oh, my God. And I didn't realize that. And so at that point, I was kind of shaken up. And continued to read and came across one statement in the magazine that was just a shocker. And I'll just read you the statement. It's called the Fatwa. And it was actually published in El Quds, Al Abira, on February 23, 1998. Now, this was in this magazine of February 11, 2001. To kill Americans and their allies, both civil and military, is an individual duty of every Muslim who is able in any country where this is possible. By God's leave, we call on every Muslim who believes in God and hopes for a reward to obey God's command to kill Americans and plunder their possessions whenever he finds them and whenever he can. And when I read that, I was so stunned, I just sat there in disbelief. And the problem is I had traveled all around the world, and July of 2000, I had gone through the Dusseldorf train station in Germany. And I walked by five Middle Eastern people sitting in the train station at a restaurant, and I had on these very dark glasses, and they looked at me when I walked by them like they were going to kill me. I was so shaken that I was trembling. And I thought at first, well, they don't like Americans. And then I looked at myself and realized I look like a German, and I speak German, so they couldn't tell the difference. And I thought, man, they read this stuff to kill Americans on top of this kind of natural antipathy that they have for Westerners. And I'm dead, because I was going to go off to Germany in March, and I was going to do the same trip. I was going to fly into Frankfurt, take a train up to Dusseldorf, switch the train in Dusseldorf, and go up to Hanover. And I thought I was going to be murdered in Hanover. So what I did is I decided to really look into this and try to understand what this meant and what the mentality was of the people behind the statement. And I immediately realized there was this mammoth paradox behind the statement. Are you aware of this paradox?
Well, you go ahead and tell us what it was.
Well, the paradox is what I call the laws and pluses and minuses. Every time you do an action...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here.
Okay.
Well, I guess it's Robert Schopmeyer. Robert, you tell us about the paradox.
The paradox is every time you do an action, like you move a cup of coffee from point A to point B, there's a negative. There's the energy that it takes to move the cup of coffee, but there's a positive. It's closer to your hand, so it's easier, more convenient to pick it up. Well, I was trying to figure out what the pluses and minuses were for the terrorists to print this statement. It had been published worldwide. And I could figure out the negatives. The negatives were the Americans going to read this, go over and cluster bomb basically the bastards in their training camps in Afghanistan. I just literally could not understand what was the positive in their minds that would have ever allowed them to publish such a horrendous statement. And I was sitting there for a few minutes trying to figure it out and was giving myself a headache. And I realized that there were two ways you could figure this out. You could use an intellectual approach. An intellectual approach is kind of like where you add one to one and get two. Or you can use an emotional approach. An emotional approach is similar to where you try to put their thinking in your head and then look at the problem through their eyes. It's similar to a fisherman. A fisherman sometimes says, to catch a fish, you have to think like a fish. Well, it's a lot easier to think like a terrorist than it is to think like a fish. So I spent about 2 hours to try to embed in my brain their mindset so I could understand their thinking and actually try to look through their eyes at the world so I could understand why they had published this. And what I did is I went back to the Muslim religion and tried to understand what was it in that religion that made them so fervently anti-American, anti-Western. And then I took bin Laden's life from the time he was 8 until he was an adult and just imagined myself going through his life with the constraint of the Muslim religion on top of that and the constraint that he had been in a large family with lots of sons and daughters, and he was one of the very oldest sons. And his mother had died, so he had lost his contact with his father, which made him very bitter, which made him even more, probably more, attracted to a very extremist Islamic thought. And it took me about 2 hours to get his mindset in my head, and it was actually a fairly simple process. I could just imagine myself as bin Laden until I could actually write a document that was part of this fatwa. And the document that the fatwa appeared in is called the Declaration of the Jihad Against Jews and Christians. It's called the World Islamic Front Statement. And I could actually imagine myself being bin Laden until I could actually write that statement, which is about a page and a half long, word for word. And it took, like I say, it took me about 2 hours. When I finally had the mindset of bin Laden, I went back to try to analyze the attacks that they had taken, that had taken place by the Al-Qaeda terrorists in the previous years, the Khobar Towers attack in 96, the East Africa bombings in 98, and the coal bombing in 2000.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here.
Okay.
Well, yeah, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Robert Schopmeyer. We're talking about his book on 9/11. And, of course, basically he had come across in a magazine this fatwa that had been put out by bin Laden talking about the destruction of America, the attack on America. And so Robert had sat down and tried to put himself into the mindset of bin Laden. Why would he feel the way he did? And of course he had come to the conclusion, well, you picked the story up there.
Well, what I did is I then went through the various attacks, and of course the attack on the Khobar Towers essentially was an attack that tried to get the Americans out of the Saudi Peninsula. And in this Declaration of Jihad Against Jews and Christians, it says the first thing they want to do is take back their very sacred shrines in Medina and Mecca. So basically they were doing exactly what they said in the jihad. The second attack that really makes sense from an analysis standpoint was the coal bombing. And I wasn't analyzing it from the tactical information, the bits of the bomb. I was analyzing it for what was in their mind when they did that attack. And I came to the conclusion that what was in their mind was they thought they were going to use four weapons against the coal: secrecy, suicide, surprise, and psychology. And I came to the conclusion that they had thought by using those weapons that they could literally attack successfully any target on planet Earth, even the most modern warship that had a 5-inch cannon on the deck. And I realized immediately that if they used those weapons against the coal, they must have known they could use those weapons before they hit the coal. In fact, when they started planning the attack on the coal, which must have been several years before the attack. And if they could use those weapons on the coal, they could use those weapons on any target on planet Earth, even the biggest buildings in the biggest U.S. cities.
But of course, now the coal was a United States warship that was actually
in Yemen.
In Yemen, and so it was 1999, wasn't it?
It was 2000, and they blew a giant hole in it and killed 17 sailors.
Right.
And when I realized what they were thinking, I kept thinking, my God, the FBI agents are out there picking up the little bits of the bomb. They're picking up the body parts, but they've overlooked the strategic importance of this whole attack. The attack told the bin Laden organization, They could attack any target anywhere on planet Earth, including the biggest buildings in the biggest U.S. cities. And I went, oh, my God. Oh, my God. And I thought, doesn't the FBI realize this? So then it was ready to go back to the fatwa. Now, they, now in the magazine, they described a press conference in May 28, 1998. So I pretended I was bin Laden, went to the press conference, and I started off and I said, okay, it's to kill Americans and their allies, both military and, or civil and military, is an individual duty of every Muslim. And I stopped right there and I said, now, why am I doing that? And I said, oh, my God. Oh, my God. I've just declared war on the United States, and I'm going to mount a massive attack inside the United States. Right then and there, I knew that they were going to, at that point, their mindset was that they, the only reason they issued that fatwa was because in their mind, they wanted to kind of pre-announce this massive attack inside the United States. And then I went back to try to justify this from an intellectual standpoint, and I realized that this fatwa had been issued 10 years after they started Al-Qaeda. And they would never issue a horrendous statement like that unless, again, in their own mind, they had some arterial motive. And the, what the motive was to try to issue these kind of these subtle hints of what they were going to do, get there in the mindset of every extremist Islamic person in the world, the fact that they're going to carry out an attack, in this case, an attack inside the United States, and then establish their position as the most maniacal terrorist organization in the world by doing this. And the only way they can actually succeed if they carried out the attack. So my feeling was once they'd issued this fatwa, they were forced to carry out a massive terrorist attack inside the United States. So the first question that I'd ask, what had motivated them, I had answered, and they'd come up with the question, now what was the target? So I was trying to figure out what was this target. And I came up with a couple criteria. It had to be a massive target. It was 3 years since they'd issued the fatwa when I was on the airplane. They weren't going to throw a grenade at a McDonald's in Cincinnati after 3 years. It had to be a gigantic target. Had to kill lots of civilians and had to essentially be a slap in the face of every American. So it had to be an extremely highly visible target. And I sat there for 45 minutes and was straining my brain and couldn't figure anything out. Gave up, decided that I was just too hard, and laid down the magazine, picked up the travel brochure on the seat pocket in front of my seat, and right on the front cover was the picture of the World Trade Center. And when I saw the picture of the World Trade Center, I was so stunned I couldn't breathe for a few seconds. And then I started screaming, and I screamed out, oh, my God, I know what that goddamn bastard is going to do next. And it was obvious he was going to blast these buildings to smithereens. And then I said, well, but they hit him in 1993 with a truck bomb. They couldn't use truck bombs again. They had two choices. They could use spitballs from across the street, or they could use hijacked airplanes. Well, I didn't figure they were going to use spitballs. They had to use hijacked airplanes. And I was on a 757, so I figured they're going to have to use a similar airplane. And came to the conclusion that from the picture that they were going to have to use two planes per building. So that would be a total of four planes. They were going to kind of do a pincer movement on the building, or pincer attack, with four airplanes. And then I thought, well, now can I figure out when this attack is going to take place? So I thought you'd have four airplanes, you're going to have to train four pilots. The most logical place to train them would be in the United States because that's where the training would be the least expensive. So I put together a plan that would take a year to train four pilots. So I'm a pilot, so I know approximately how long it's going to take. They'd have to get their instrument rating, probably their commercial rating. They would probably be able to get about 200 hours, but they'd have to get flight training on the type of airplanes they were going to hijack. Now, four airplanes meant they'd have to hijack a type of plane that had the same cockpit. If you had multiple airplanes, it'd have to have the exact same cockpit. And I knew the only airplane that had that was the 767 and the 757. So I came to the conclusion they were going to hijack 767s and 757s. And it would take a year to train the pilots. They'd have to spend 3 months. So from the time they entered the United States until they got settled down, got into their flight schools, it was going to be 3 months. 3 months to bring in the non-pilots, a month to put them together, which is 18 months plus a month, 19 months. And I went back to the date in February 1998 when they issued the fatwa, and I started to lay the timeline on top of that date. Well, that didn't work out because the buildings would have come down in September of 99, and I'm on the airplane in February of 2001 where the buildings were still there. So I went back, and I came to the conclusion they had to have had working on this long before I figured it out. I just didn't think I was that smart to figure it out as soon as they were. Had started working on it. So I assumed that they had put in a significant amount of time. Now, The only magic number I had between 3 years and my date was 1 year. If I put down 2 years, that still wouldn't work. The billings would have still been down before I even got on the airplane. So I put down 1 year, which would have been February of 2000, and said, okay, if they started entering in the United States in February of 2000, that's February, March, April, they're bringing in the terrorists. May they start their flight training. You know when they started their flight training? May of 2000. A year later, in April of 2001, they're done. May, June, and July, they bring in the non-pilot hijackers, and they would never bring those guys in until the pilots were done. They would be just too afraid they'd have too many people in the United States that would give away their plans. So May, June, and July, they bring in the rest of the hijackers, which would amount to about 19 or 20 hijackers. In August, they put them together. September 1st, they'd be ready to go. By the middle of September, it'd be over. And guess what happened with September? September came right between August, the attack on East Africa embassies, and October, the attack on the coal, and I went, oh, my God, that's got to be the right date. And so now I know what the date is. At least in my mind, I have a concept of the date. And I was just, at this point, I'm just absolutely horrified. So I thought, well, I'm an engineer, and I put this together, but now I'm going to prove it's not going to happen. So I went back, and I lined up quite a number of arguments to prove that they weren't going to attack the World Trade Center. And a couple of the arguments were... their organization. One of the arguments was the magnification. So I went back through my analysis and I said, okay, now let's assume that they have a choice of a couple of targets. Let's look at magnification. Let's take the World Trade Centers and compare it with the Pentagon and the Congress in terms of magnification. And in the eyes of a terrorist, a terrorist attack is kind of like a press release. The more press you get, it means the more ink you're going to get in a newspaper. So I was comparing the attack on the World Trade Centers to the attack on the Pentagon and the Congress. And I had assumed the buildings were going to collapse and that they had about 30,000 people working in the building. So I assumed that about 30,000 people would be killed in the attacks on the World Trade Center. And I put down 1 point per 1,000 people killed. So I added up 30,000 to be 30 points plus a point for the building. It came to 32. Looked at the Pentagon, and it's so flat that it would never fall over. Put down about 200 people killed, and that would take out one wedge, which would be 0.2% of the building, or 20% of the building. So you have 0.2 plus 0.2, you'd have 0.4. And the Congress would be 0.3. You'd have about a third of the Congress knocked out. The middle section underneath the dome, plus about 200 people, that's 0.5. So you'd have 32 versus 0.5 versus 0.4. It was clear from a magnification analysis they were going to go after the World Trade Center. And then I had an analysis called a chance of success. A chance of success is they pick a target that's going to give them the highest chance of success. So I picked buildings around the World Trade Center and said, well, why wouldn't they hit this and why wouldn't they hit that? And realized that once they were going to use airplanes, that the World Trade Center actually gave them the highest chance of success. They stood up out of the way. They were not surrounded by other buildings. So it was going to be going to give them the highest possible chance of success for the attack if they went after the World Trade Center. I also had a couple other ways I was trying to prove that it wasn't the World Trade Center towers. I used the attack on the coal, and I had realized that when they hit the coal, they had missed a boat at the same location. The boat was called the USS the Sullivans, which is the same type of ship. It had been in the Yemen harbor in January of 2000, and what had happened is the boat sank. So they went back after the coal 9 months later in October of 2000. So that meant that they never give up on a target once they've attacked that target. And I realized why, because in their minds they have the consciousness of that target. They put a huge effort into it, and they just don't want to give up that effort. They want to go back after that target.
All right, you hang on there. We're going to be back in just a moment with our special guest, Robert Schopmeyer, talking about his analysis that the attack was coming on September 11th. But the question is, how could he figure out what it was going to happen when our government agencies are spending billions of dollars a year, $40 billion a year, were told had no idea this was going to happen, or did they? Did they know just what he knew? Go right ahead, Robert.
Well, then I went through the East Africa bombings and the coal attack, and the coal obviously I had analyzed before, and that told me it had to be one of the biggest buildings.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances? Even things which can cause sickness or disease. If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Any failure, look at the long spans first. And the second thing is, steel has no compression strength. So I'm looking at these gigantic trusses that are holding up the building, or these gigantic columns. And I counted the columns along the south tower. There were actually 59 columns along the south tower, the front. When I counted about three times, it didn't make any sense they would have 59 columns. And I'm trying to estimate the compression force on those columns, and I estimated the compression force to be at least 2 million pounds. And I estimated that the plane would hit halfway between the tallest building and the top of the building. Well, the tallest building in the area of the South Tower was about the 50 stories. The South Tower is 110 stories. You take 50 from 110, you get 60. You divide that by 2, you get 30. It meant the plane would come in, would come down the Hudson River, swing around the New York Harbor, come in from the south, because that's the only exposed space, and hit the World Trade Center coming in from the south at about the 80th floor. And I'm looking up there, and I could see that that had to be 25% of the way down from the top. and that if you had 2 million pounds or more of compression force, that meant there were still 500,000 pounds of compression force on those outside trusses or those outside columns. And I realized you put 100,000 pounds of fuel under those long steel, they call plate trusses, that those 4 foot long rods that were welded between the top and bottom plate would just buckle. The floor would buckle. It would pull. It would either pull the outside columns in, or it would break and let the columns go. And the columns had three directions of movement: up and down, which is held up by the actual column itself; left and right, which were those big black spaces, which had to be steel plates that were holding them in laterally. And the only thing that was holding them front to back were those. They had to be a key, a truss for the key, where you put a little key in the you weld a little plate onto the. The outside column, and then the truss goes in there.
Well, now, of course, that might explain the major build, but how do you explain Building 7 coming down at 5:20 that evening?
Well, what had happened is that when the buildings came down, they came down with such a force they blew hundreds of tons of material in every direction. They landed on Building 7. 7 turned into an inferno, and the inferno lasted all day, and then the way the building had been built, they had these very long horizontal, actually solid steel, trusses inside Building 7 that warped. Once they warped, they disturbed the structure to the point where the whole thing collapsed.
But the building came down from the bottom. In other words, the top caved in, and then the base of the building dissolved. That doesn't sound like it was from fire. I've seen it. It sure looked like a controlled demolition to me.
Well, here's the problem. Anytime something like that collapses, you have what's called chaos, and chaos is a situation that you can't even estimate. If you go out and look at a stream and ask a physicist to give you formulas to estimate the hydrology of the stream, it's impossible. In other words, and if you look at a rapids, the rapids should not look like that. They should have a nice smooth flow. They shouldn't be just chaos. Once you get into a system where there's total chaos, there's no way that physics or analysis can estimate what's going on. And I estimate that, again, in the World Trade Centers, it was the horizontal trusses that failed. Once they failed, and they failed because of the vertical supports that were holding up those trusses. Once the vertical supports or the horizontal trusses failed, then the outside trusses would have no support, or the outside columns would have no support, front to back, and they'd collapse, and the whole damn thing would come down like a house of cards.
But, you know, the thing that bothers me about that is, then what happened to all the cement? All the cement was pulverized, and there were 1,100 bodies that simply disappeared. They were vaporized.
They
How would a pancake collapse have vaporized human bodies? In fact, all the furniture, almost everything in that building was vaporized. How did that happen?
Well, when I was down there, I realized the buildings were going to collapse. In fact, I got down on my knees and I just wept. And I was planning to go to the FBI, and I realized I go down to the FBI and tell them that the planes are going to hit these buildings in September, and the buildings are going to collapse, and everybody's going to be killed. They're going to think I'm a nutcase. And I just assumed that the Building 7, it was on fire all day. It had a great big tank in there that was full of diesel fuel, and the tank caught fire. And then the fire was intense, but it just caused the thing to structurally fail.
Well, is there any incidents in all history where a steel-reinforced building has collapsed directly as a result of fire?
Well, is there any instance in history where a 100,000-pound plane, a 767, has flown into a building with about 100 to 150,000 pounds of fuel? There just is no incidence of where that's ever happened before. So.
Well, of course, but what about the Building 7? There was no airplane hit Building 7. We're going to be...
Well, that's true, but what had happened is that these giant pieces of steel that came flying off the building landed on Building 7, and the whole thing caught on fire.
But how would that make it collapse from the bottom? I mean, actually, if you've seen pictures of Building 7 come down, I don't know if you've studied them, but basically the top of the building simply collapsed as if somebody destroyed the major structure, and then the base of the building simply dissolved. Hold that. We'll be back in just a moment here with our special guest, Robert Schaubmeier. This is Dr. Stan. Robert, go right ahead.
Well, I don't want to get into Building 7 because it's just too far off the subject, and I'm not structurally professional enough to go into that in any kind of structural analysis detail, but let me just go on with my story.
All right, go right ahead with your story.
So then I came back to California, told all my employees those buildings were going to be smashed to smithereens, And one of my employees asked me in June, we were going to fly out to Las Vegas, what are we going to do if the terrorists are on our airplane? Going to Las Vegas. I said, for Christ's sake, Katrina, that the terrorists would never go to Las Vegas. They're Muslims. That's Sin City. They wouldn't be caught dead in Sin City. But just in case, I'll get the whole company together. I'd already told everybody in the company about this attack anyway. So I got everybody together, and I told them, look, so one of our employees thinks that there may be terrorists on our airplane. Look for them. They'll be easy to spot. They'll be in twos and threes. They don't like Americans. They'll be sitting down and whispering to each other. Look them in the face. They'll never give you eye contact. When you see them, get the hell off the plane. And then I said something that was really strange. I said, don't tell the authorities. The laws of this country have been designed to let these terrorists get on these airplanes unmolested. They're not going to arrest them. They're going to arrest you. And they're going to sue me. So keep your mouth shut. And it turns out that was the second week of June. Well, it turns out the terrorists actually flew out to Los Angeles, got on the same airline that we were on, National Airlines, and flew over to Las Vegas the same week we were there.
My goodness, what were these terrorists doing in Las Vegas? I thought
they were hitting the strip clubs.
Well, I see. These were not then really the fundamentalist
Islamists who were told about. They were just into naked strippers.
In other words, but they see, really, a stripped Islamic a fundamentalist would be abhorrent by seeing
well,
a woman.
Well, never underestimate the power of a naked woman on the mindset of even in the most ardent terrorist. So then I flew out to Boston on September 8th. I went through Logan Airport looking for the hijackers. I thought they'd be there for sure, trying to get those knives, figure out how to get those knives to security. And I missed them by about 3 hours. And at the time I missed them, I thought maybe they moved the attack out. Well, that was on Saturday, which was September 8th. On Sunday, I realized, nope, they hadn't moved the attack out. I came to the conclusion the attack was going to take place the next week. And I went into such a state of shock and just horror, I just didn't know what to do. I mean, I was literally, my head was going to explode. Didn't know what to do. Didn't think I could go to the FBI. Thought if I went to the FBI, I'd probably be arrested. I didn't do anything. And then I went to a demo out in Lowell. I was actually in Newton, Massachusetts. Now, if you can imagine this, the terrorists that hijacked the 175, United 175, were actually in Newton. They were in the park in Newton, about 2 miles away from the Marriott Newton, for 3 days. Well, obviously, I wouldn't know that. Then I drove up to Lowell, Massachusetts, and had a demo on Tuesday, the 9th. Right in the middle of the demo, they came running in and said they had this big issue in New York City. The demo was canceled. So I said, I'll invite everybody over for breakfast. We're over there watching breakfast, and the buildings came down.
All right, fine. We'll be right back in just a moment here.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Robert Schopenhauer has written a book about his prior knowledge of the building was going to come down, but he didn't bother to tell the FBI. He was afraid if he told the FBI they'd say he was crazy or arrest him. He said that he talked to everybody with the firm he headed, and so they knew about it, but do you think the FBI, looking back on it, don't you think the FBI knew that those buildings were going to come down?
So as soon as I had the attack got back or took place, I went back to my hotel, called the FBI, and told them the whole thing because I thought if they found out from my employees, I'd be arrested. So called the FBI and told them I know the whole thing. My whole company knew the whole thing, and they said this is the Boston place. They said the FBI in Boston said they were too busy. So I got back to San Francisco, called up the San Francisco office, got a Robert Stove, and he just went into a screaming fit. He just screamed at me, "How the hell did you know this?" And just screaming. And I said, "Man, slow down, and I can give you a sit-down demo or a sit-down interview." And he said, "Well, talk to the people in San Jose." So I called up the people in San Jose, went down to Vince Taglieri, and told him the whole thing. And I asked him, I said, "Do you think I killed all those people on 9/11? If I'd come in here in February, would you have done anything?" I said, "I knew they were going to hijack four planes. I knew there were 767 and 757s hijacked out of eastern airports. They were going to use four-inch knives. I knew the target was the World Trade Center. I didn't have the day."
How did you know they were going to use four-inch knives?
Because I had been terrified since the middle 90s of four-inch knives on the airplane. I was sitting in front of the TV in the middle 90s, and the announcer came on and said, "The FAA just announced that they're going to allow you to bring on a four-inch knife." And I went, "Oh, my God, what in the hell are they doing?"
Well, maybe they were making it easy for the terrorists to come on.
Oh, God, I haven't any idea. So anyway, I gave this information to the San Jose people at least four times. I gave this information to the Minneapolis agent, Colleen Rowley, that was involved in the Zacharias Moussaoui thing. And then I called up the Joint Inquiry Committee of the House and the Senate when they were having their investigation and talked to a Rick Cinquegrani, Cinquegrani, Cinquegrani. He was actually number two behind Eleanor Hill on this investigation, told them. And I got back a statement from them that said, we agree with the FBI that you should not be personally liable for these attacks. The FBI had as much information, we think, as you did.
All right. Well, why don't you just tell our listeners how they can get a copy of your book?
Well, they can go to my website, www.eventson911. It's all one word, no hyphens, no dashes. Eventson911.com. And the book's right on the website. Plus, I've got all the documents on the website.
Well, of course, you know, the amazing thing is if you really study this very carefully, it's very obvious the government knew the attack was coming.
Here's what I found out. Let me just tell you what I found out. I found out that there's a document called the Substitution for the Testimony of John. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I haven't.
If you go to the Massawi exhibits, it's in the Massawi exhibits, and I'll give you the website for the Massawi exhibits, and I'll give you what's in the Substitution for the Testimony of John, and when you read it, you want to die. Here's the website for the Massawi exhibits. It's www.vaed.uscourts.gov/notable-cases/Massawi/exhibits. Now, in there, there's this document called it's called the Substitution for the Testimony of John. That was entered into the Massawi trial. Now John he's actually Tom Wilshire. He was a former deputy chief of the Bin Laden unit. And if you can imagine this, his email back to his headquarters at the CI says this. On July 23, he had asked that the information on the Kuala Lumpur meeting, that's where the terrorists had actually planned these attacks in Kuala Lumpur, he'd asked that the information on that meeting be given to the FBI both on July 10, 2001 and July 23. Now, July 23, he says, when the next big op is carried out by UBL hardcore cadre, that's the Al-Qaeda terrorists, people who are close to Khalid, he's the guy that was the mastermind of the co-bombing, Khalid El-Mihdhar, should be of very high interest given his connection to, it must be, the co-bombing. So he knew in July that Khalid El-Mihdhar and his travel companion, Nirpa Hazmi, would take part in this gigantic attack. And he sends that back to his boss. Now, his boss was head of the Bin Laden unit at the CIA. That guy's boss was Copper Black, head of the CTC section of the CIA. And his boss was George Tenet. So now he's telling everybody at the CIA that the Mihdhar and Hazmi are going to take part in this gigantic attack. Well, on August 22nd, Margaret Gillespie, who worked at the CIA, found out that Mihdhar and Hazmi were inside the United States, and he took this information back to Tom Wilshire and Dina Corsi. Now, Wilshire and Corsi are the two that set up a meeting between the CIA and the FBI on June 11, 2001, and one of the people at the meeting was Steve Bongard. And Corsi presented three photographs taken at Kuala Lumpur of Mihdhar. And Clark Shannon, who worked for Wilshire, looked at Bongard and said, "You recognize anybody in the photographs?" And clearly what the CIA was doing is trying to find out if the information which they've been trying to keep secret, the information on Kuala Lumpur meeting, if it had been found out by the FBI criminal investigators. And when Bongard said that they didn't recognize anybody, and they asked the people at the meeting, Clark Shannon and Dina Corsi, "Who are these people? Why are you asking us? We're the co-bombing investigators. What have they got to do with the co-bombing?" Shannon and Corsi said, "We can't tell you. We got to keep it a secret." It turns out they knew that Mihdhar and Hazmi had been at the meeting in Kuala Lumpur with Khalid Benitesh, knew they had planned the co-bombing, and here they're talking to the co-bombing investigators, and they're not going to give them the names of the people that had taken part in the co-bombing. Can you imagine that?
Well, I could if they really weren't trying to stop the terrorist attacks.
Well, here, it's even worse than that.
I mean, if they were actually fomenting this whole terrorist movement because we needed an enemy, this would be exactly what you'd do.
Well,
you'd block every effort to try to stop what was going on.
I'll tell you what I know. Okay, so on the 22nd, Wilshire and Corsi know that Mihdhar and Hazmi are in the U.S. They both know these two terrorists are going to take part in this gigantic attack. So what do they do? The first thing they do is try to keep this information away from Steve Bongard. They know if Bongard gets this information and the photograph of Benitesh comes over that was taken at Kuala Lumpur, comes over to Bongard, he would know immediately that he'd been criminally obstructed at that meeting in June 11th. So they were doing everything they could. What turns out, on August 28th, Bongard accidentally gets the EC that Corsi wrote up to start the investigation of Mihdhar and calls up Corsi and says, "Hey, look, I think this guy is connected to the co-bombing. You've got to give me this investigation." And Corsi says, "You're not allowed to have the investigation. The information comes from the NSA. And because it comes from the NSA, they prohibit criminal FBI investigators from getting this information." Now, here's the problem with that. On the 27th, just the day before, she had already gotten the release from the NSA. In fact, it's evidence item that's in the Massawi trial, if you go to that location, it's item 448. And it says, your request on behalf of Dina Corsi to share sanitized information on Khalid al-Mihdhar with FBI investigators in the New York office. And it goes on to say FBI criminal investigators has been approved.
Well, then why do you think that the CIA was blocking the information from getting to the FBI so that they could do something to try to stop the attack? I mean,
well, here's the issue. It wasn't the CIA hiding information from the FBI. It was the CIA working with FBI agents at FBI headquarters trying to keep the information away from the FBI criminal investigators on the coal bombing. They knew that they had been hiding the information from the criminal investigators on the coal bombing in event after event. They had hidden this information.
Well,
they knew that was criminal.
That they're involved, that the CIA agents were involved in criminal activity. Why hasn't anything ever been done against them? Why aren't they at least partly responsible for the death of almost 3,000 people
totally
who died?
Well, here it's even worse than that. So Corsi tells Bongard he's not allowed to be part of this investigation because they don't have a release when they'd already gotten the release the day before. So Bongard says, look, I don't think this has anything to do with FISA. That's the only reason I would not be allowed to have this information. Talk to the attorneys at the headquarters and see if I can have this investigation. Corsi comes back the next day, that's on August 29th, and tells Bongard that the attorneys have ruled that he can't be part of the investigation. But on November 7th, 2002, Sherry Sable, who was the attorney Corsi had contacted, tells FBI or the DOJ investigators that she didn't give that advice to Corsi, that she told Corsi that Bongard could be part of the investigation because the information from the NSA had nothing to do with FISA. And if Corsi was confused, she could go to the NSA to get the release herself, unaware she'd gotten it 2 days before.
Well, then why has nothing ever been done to the CIA agents?
Because the Joint Inquiry Committee of the House and Senate and the 9/11 Commission were set up for two reasons. They already knew that the CIA and the FBI headquarters, not the FBI field agents, those are good guys, the FBI headquarters, had criminally obstructed the coal investigation and had criminally shut down investigations that could have prevented the attacks, and knew that the FBI headquarters agents and the CIA had deliberately and intentionally and knowingly allowed the attacks on 9/11 to take place.
And I think you're saying that the FBI headquarters had criminally involved, knowing the attack was coming, and
yes,
did not try to stop it. This is your contention.
And shut down all investigations. They even shut down the investigation of Harry Sam at Minneapolis, of Zacharias Massawi. And here's what's even more horrible. On August 24th, Wilshire makes contact with Maltby and Fresca. Those are the two guys that were shutting down Harry Sam's investigation. So on the 24th of August, Wilshire already knows that Mihdhar and Hazmi are in the U.S. to take part in this huge attack, already knows that Massawi, who was thought to be an al-Qaeda terrorist learning how to fly a 747, has been arrested, and now knows that people are shutting down Harry Samet's investigation. Now, the problem was the 9/11 Commission was not set up to investigate this. They were set up for one purpose, to prove to the American people that the FBI and CIA had not deliberately allowed these attacks.
And, of course, you feel that they did, and that the 9/11 Commission was a whitewash. Would that be a fair statement?
It was worse than a whitewash. It was a criminal conspiracy to hide the culpability of the CIA and FBI in deliberately allowing these attacks that took place on 9/11.
Well, I certainly would tend to agree with you totally. There's no
question. No, on my website, I actually have the release. So if you go to www.events on 9/11.com, I actually have that release that given to Corsi. I actually have Sherry Sable's testimony. I actually have the substitution for the testimony of John. I actually have the account of FBI agent Ali Safan, who testified 2 weeks ago in front of Congress. And if you go through Safan's account, you realize every time he asked the CIA for this information, he was told there was no information. Now, one of the people he asked was the director of the FBI, Louis Free, on November 2000. But in January of 2000 and in December of 1999, Free had been given this information by both the CIA and by the NSA. And when in November 2000, when Safan asked Free said, oh, the CIA doesn't have any of this information, when Free himself knew that this information was at the CIA because the CIA had given him this exact information.
So what is your contention? Why did they lie? Why did they not try to stop the attack? And
well,
why
I'll tell you what I think. I'll tell you what my analysis is. On January 4, 2000... they identified the photograph of Benitez taken at Kuala Lumpur, and the CIA knew immediately that they had photographed all the people at that meeting, let them walk away, that was in January 2000, let them walk away, and thought they were culpable in the coal bombing. So from January 4th, 2001 onward, they were trying to keep that secret so that they would not be besmirched by having been culpable in the attack on the coal. Now, why they were hiding information on Mihdhar, because this whole conspiracy actually started when Wilshire blocked FBI agent Doug Miller's cable that had all the information on Mihdhar in January 5th, 2000, just before the meeting started in Kuala Lumpur. Why they were doing it at that point, I haven't any idea. I came up with a theory that Mihdhar had come in contact with Ali Mohammed, who had worked on the East Africa bombings, and Mohammed was actually a high-level al-Qaeda terrorist who worked inside the FBI and actually worked inside the CIA, and both of them had decided that they didn't want Mohammed exposed. They brought him in under arrest after the East Africa bombings and kept his name as John Doe, and they didn't want Mihdhar to be arrested and expose Mohammed. Now, that's the only reason that I could come up with why they were hiding the information from January 5th up to the attack on the coal. But after the attack on the coal, it was clear that the CIA knew immediately they were involved in or was culpable in the attack and wanted to keep that secret.
Well, for our listeners out there, if you've never read the story of Ali Mohammed, it's really one of the most interesting ones. It's an excellent book called Triple Cross, which goes into the background of this man who actually had planned the bombing of the American embassies
Can you come up with any other reason why they...
In Tanzania, and he had even been training, he was working for the FBI, and he was training Osama bin Laden's bodyguard. They called him a triple agent. I really think he was a quadruple agent.
Dan, can you imagine this? He was actually in Santa Clara, and he's the guy that brought in Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was bin Laden's second in command, and drove him around Santa Clara collecting money at the mosque in Santa Clara.
I mean, there's a lot of this...
1995.
But the question is, why were they covering this up, and why did they
refuse to? Because the CIA doesn't want to be embarrassed by the fact they had allowed the attacks on the coal bombing.
What about the fact that they allowed the bombing, the attack on the World Trade Center? They already
knew what was nobody. I mean, here's the problem: they were hiding this information, but they continued to hide it after they knew this huge attack was going to take place. After they knew that Mihdhar and Hosni were going to take part in this attack. And knew that their actions would result in the deaths of thousands of Americans. They just didn't give two rats' ass for the American people. They thought, we're going to stay out of prison. We don't care if these people die. We're just going to keep ourselves out of prison.
Well, now, were these two agents that you're speaking about, the two...
What's worse than that?
Are these the fellows who was actually living, I think, down in San Diego with an FBI undercover?
No. Mihdhar and Hosni, yeah, had been living in San Diego with
FBI informant.
Well, an informant that worked for Stephen Bench.
Here are these two Islamic terrorists are living with an FBI informant in San Diego, and the FBI can't find them. And their names were in the telephone book, but the FBI is so incompetent,
it had to do with criminal obstruction of FBI investigations.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And the thing is that we've never been told the truth about what happened that tragedy.
Well, here's the thing. I put all this together, and then I contacted FBI agents to see what they thought of my conclusions. And you know what their reaction was?
What was the reaction?
Oh, my God. Bob, where the hell did you find that? Like, for example, I said, when Corsi told the team that was investigating the coal bombing that they weren't allowed to investigate Mihdhar, did they know that Corsi already knew that the CIA had been hiding the photograph of Benitez from then, knew that connected Mihdhar and Hosni to the planning of the coal bombing? Did they know that? And they went, oh, my God, where the hell did you find that? And I said, that's on page 305 of the DOJIG report. And I said, were you aware when Margaret Gillespie found that Mihdhar and Hosni were in the United States and took that to Tom Wilshire, were you aware that Wilshire knew these terrorists were going to take part in a huge attack inside the United States? And they said, oh, my God, where the hell did you find that? And I said, it's in the substitution for the testimony of John. It's in it was entered in the evidence in the trial for Massawi on March 11th, 2006, and I'll send you the document. They just didn't know what was going on.
Well,
I never told them that Corsi had the release. I never told them that Corsi had fabricated the testimony of Sherry Sable. I just thought that was too horrific. I thought they were going to all have heart attacks if I told them that.
Well, what are you doing to try to bring the people who are at least in part responsible for what happened before
the
Justice?
There's nothing you can do. I put a book out, and I even had a press release last year on September 11, 2008. I had a press release at the National Press Club, and the press release went around the world to maybe 100,000 websites. And I put the book out that has all this information in it, and it has every single page number from every single report. It turns out there's more than enough documentation now that's public, that you can put this all together. Now, what I had to do is I had to go through the Joint Inquiry Committee of the House and the Senate. I had to go through the 9/11 Commission report. I had to go through the Department of Justice Inspector General's report. And I put all that together with the account of FBI agent Ali Safwan and combined that with the evidence items from the Massawi trial, and then I put big timelines together to figure out who knew what when, how did they get the information, what did they do with it. And now on my website, I've boiled it all down so anybody can read this information and see the actual...
And what's your website? What's more, what's your website?
www.eventson911.com. And let me just
eventson911.com. The book is entitled Fire Knowledge of 911. Is that right?
It started out with the fact that I had known about it, and then it ended up with the fact that the CIA and the FBI had known about this huge attack. And it wasn't... I don't want to blame the FBI. It was the FBI headquarters. The agents in the field are heroes.
All right, hold that. We'll be back in just a moment here. And you're right. They wanted to do what was right, but the people at the upper echelon had a different agenda. Well, Robert, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
With food prices soaring to all-time highs, as the dollar continues to fall in value, what can you and your family do to guarantee that fresh, nutritious vegetables will make it to your dinner table? Garden in a Can. Garden in a Can is your source for premium, long-term storable seeds. Garden in a Can is ready when you are. Plant them now or store them for when you really need them. There are 16 large, hermetically sealed, non-hybrid, open-pollinated packets of seeds, along with detailed planting instructions sealed in a can for ultimate long-term protection. Garden in a Can. It's that simple. Fresh, healthy, easy. Only $69.95 for over a half acre of safe, fresh vegetables. Ready when you are. Stop procrastinating and start preparing with Garden in a Can. For more details, visit GardenInACan.com today. That's GardenInACan.com or call 866-598-7396, 866-598-7396.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Here's for 9/11 Truth. We carry his DVD, Blueprint for Truth, the story of 9/11. And, of course, it is his contention that the buildings came down because, of course, the use of thermite, and this has actually been found in the dust. But be that as it may, there's no question at all they had prior knowledge of what was going to happen, and they didn't try to stop it. You have to ask yourself, why? Unless, of course, maybe they wanted to get into a war with Iraq. They wanted a justification to get to war with Afghanistan, and they knew the American people would never go to war. The American people didn't want to go to war. They had to come up with an excuse to go to war. And unfortunately, this sort of thing has happened over and over again. Let me suggest the DVD, Blueprint for Truth, and we carry that. It's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We have about a half a dozen or more different DVDs where you'll actually see the buildings come down. And if you don't want to get a DVD, you can go to our website, radioliberty.com, scroll down to other videos, and then go to the one on building number 7 and watch it come down a few times. You'll realize, of course, this is a controlled demolition. Well, if Building 7 was a controlled demolition, then the others were, and the reason they didn't try to stop it is they wanted the buildings to come down. They wanted the Americans to die. Is there any precedent for this? Of course there is. The sinking of the Lusitania in World War I, the attack on the Maine to get us into the War of 18, the Spanish-American War in 1898, the allowing the attack on Pearl Harbor, concealing the truth about the fact that the American corporations were providing the weapons for Adolf Hitler so he would have the equipment to launch a war in Europe. And, of course, if we go into the background of the Korean War, how we were never allowed to win the war, how the background of the Vietnam War, there was no Gulf of Tonkin attack. We sent our boys over there never to win. I personally talked to the ambassador, Wade Sullivan, ambassador to Laos, and to General Lewis Wald, a four-star Marine general. Both of them told me we could have won the war in Vietnam in 2 months if we'd been allowed to attack North Vietnam. We were never allowed to win the war any more than we're allowed to win the war in Afghanistan. It'll go on and on and on. And ladies and gentlemen, wars are never fought for the reason that the men are told who are sent overseas to fight and bleed and suffer and die. Henry Kissinger said it best in the book The Final Days by Woodward and Bernstein. I think it's page 96, but you'll find the exact references. Our syllabus on Iraq, The Untold Story. The military are simply stupid, dumb animals. Stupid, dumb animals to be used for foreign policy purposes. That's what the elite, epitomized by Henry Kissinger, think of our brave fighting men, stupid, dumb animals. And that's why they sent them off to fight and bleed and suffer and die in wars that they're never allowed to win. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Let me suggest our talk on Iraq, The Untold Story, and the syllabus that goes with that. We'll give you the documentation on that, and of course the background of the war in Iraq, which was planned long before. I mean, you read the material put out by the neoconservative movement, Project for the New American Century. You can go to their website. They, of course, keep pulling it down from time to time, but we pull down everything from their website and put it into our syllabus. You need to read it. You need to understand there are people who said quite openly, we will keep our troops in the Middle East indefinitely. We have no intention of pulling them out. Don't believe what the politicians are telling you. Don't believe what happened on September 11th was what you were told happened. Those people were left there to die by the invisible government. If you don't know who they are, of course, you need to get my membership list of the Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to hear my new talk on the financial Armageddon. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.